Kia ora world, I'm Kaz.
I'm Liz.
And I'm Lindy.
And together we are Cult Chat. We're coming to you over the airways from little old Aotearoa, New Zealand, land of flightless birds, hobbits, marmite, and also some really wacky groups. And that's why we're here.
On Cult Chat, we ask whether Kiwis know how to recognise a culty group and give tips on how to sniff out the telltale signs that a group is harmful.
Join us as we unpack the cult playbook, talk to survivors of New Zealand cults, and interview experts in the field. Journey with us as we traverse the cultiverse.
Cult Chat is available on various streaming platforms and social media.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Sarah is a cult survivor, domestic violence survivor, and a survivor of trafficking and modern slavery. She wouldn't have been able to name these things as she was experiencing them, or even for some time in the aftermath. Like many cult survivors, Sarah can draw a line between the coercive behaviours that she experienced in the high-demand organisation she was brought up in, Kwasi's Ubuntu, and the coercive behaviours of those who abused and exploited her later in life. Now Sarah uses her experiences to advocate for change. She's a fierce defender of the rights of others who have suffered from abuse, and I have huge admiration for her. She has recently launched Survivor Connections, a resource she built alongside survivors for others who have experienced exploitation to assist them with all the things she wishes she knew earlier on. I was so pleased to be able to speak with Sarah for today's episode. Welcome to Let's Talk About Sects, a podcast about cults from around the world. I'm your host, Sarah Steele. Before we start, a content warning. This episode deals with trauma, child abuse, sexual abuse, and rape. Please use your discretion as to whether this will be suitable for you and those around you who may be listening too.
Sarah, thanks so much for joining me today. Can you tell me a bit about your childhood and the religious organisation that you were born into?
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here. So I guess this all started before I was born, really. My parents had encountered a religious organization and spent time in South Africa at a place called Kwasi's Ubuntu Mission. You'll probably hear me refer to this as KSB or the mission, mostly. A bit of a complicated name, but it actually comes from the Zulu language and means the place where people are helped. Ironically, KSB was an organization that was founded in South Africa. And I guess the main compound there is in a fairly remote part of KwaZulu-Natal. I guess something like a gated community or a self-sufficient community that contains a school, it has a teacher's training college, and businesses like the Aquele water bottling factory and Nsani Farms. There's also a mess hall and kitchens for communal dining and nightly services and accommodation for its followers and workers and an auditorium for the Sunday with a larger church services, I guess, that had a capacity for about 10,000 people, just to give people a bit of an idea of the numbers. And I guess the time that I was affiliated with the mission, it was run by two brothers, Erlo and Friedel Stegen. And it was sort of the compound in South Africa that I spent some time in as a child, as an eight-year-old. But other than that, KSB also had a branch in Europe, whose headquarters were eventually in Switzerland. But they also had groups in several other countries like France, the Netherlands, and Germany. I was actually born in Germany. And although we didn't live in a closed community there, we regularly attended their conferences and were kind of heavily influenced by their belief structure and worldview. When I was 8 years old, we actually went and spent about 6 months' time in South Africa on the compound. And eventually when I was 11, we then moved to Australia and were part of the KSB group there in South Australia. Although there wasn't really a compound there, it was sort of a much more closed community, and my whole life became immersed in KSB until I was able to escape at about age 21. KSB's teachings sometimes been referred to as a kind of Christian-based sect or cult or a high control group. I know people are using different language around that stuff at the moment. And I guess some people might consider it sort of extremely conservative or legalistic or sort of a works-based interpretation that's kind of loosely Bible-based. But I say loosely because as many cultic or sectarian groups, I guess they believe that they've had this special enlightenment in the form of these standards that they say have been revealed to them in this spiritual revival that sets them apart from kind of like mainstream Christianity, if you will. I always really struggle to outline their belief systems in just a few sentences, and I find that when I have shared a little bit about my past, people kind of really fixate on the certain rules or the things that were kind of particularly different to mainstream society, like the conservative dress or no makeup or no jewelry, no music with a beat or restricted access to things like TV and internet. But while people, I don't know, I guess people getting hung up on those things, what we weren't allowed to do, to me is kind of less the issue. It's more for me, the issue is that it really normalized an environment that was extremely controlling, where it was normal to control people's behavior in even the minutest detail, and really coercive behavior was really normalized. So I guess it also had quite an abusive internal social structure, sort of different levels of power all the way from the peripheral lower levels sort of membership all the way up through to the co-workers and the counselors and the leaders in the inner circle. And I think the biggest thing that had an impact on me, particularly growing up there, was that to gain or maintain a position in that system, particularly if you were picked to be the target of abuse, people had to participate in behavior that put someone else in a lesser position, which was usually kind of achieved by bullying or victimizing others. And it was just something that I absolutely couldn't do. And to this day, I guess I'd still rather be on the receiving end of abuse than watch it happen to someone else. So I spent all of my later childhood, once I'd moved to Australia, and my early teens being targeted for abuse that still really impacts me heavily to this day. And ironically, it was that abuse, though, that made me first commit the cardinal sin of questioning the system, because I had to somehow reconcile in my mind that either what was happening to me was kind of God's will, as they would have said, and right, or that something was really wrong in my world, I guess. It was a really confusing time for me to try and figure out in a system that told me that I would like burn in hell for even daring to ask questions about the presented beliefs and the rules or what the leaders told us, and trying to figure out how that fit in my life as a young teenager, I guess. And there was just a lot of fear about retribution, because people who questioned things were seen as dangerous and sort of shunned and punished if they were seen to be backsliding or falling away. I guess that's probably cult baby language for those that understand those words. But I think that was the turning point for me, and the moment of kind of no return in my mind, and the moment that I chose to go up against the leadership in spite of the danger or the cost, was when I started to see that abuse that I'd been experiencing shift to other vulnerable young people. And I just couldn't stand by and watch it happen to someone else. So unfortunately, as many people who tried to speak up against the abuse that was sort of happening in that place, the response from the leadership was to blame the victim for being sinful. And they sort of said that that kind of abuse was kind of a great way to die to self, for those of us that understand this concept from those kind of backgrounds, this kind of extreme self-destruction on the deepest level, in which any form of kind of self-expression or expression of needs is seen as evil and selfish, and that a victim should sort of forgive and forget and not speak badly about another person. So you are kind of made to feel that you were the problem as a victim if you expressed kind of any needs or pain. So yeah, I guess that was the kind of world that I grew up in.
Yeah, and I think a lot of our listeners will probably find a lot of those things quite familiar. All of those behaviours that you've explained, I've heard about similar things from many other groups. And for listeners who do want to hear a little bit more about Kwasi Zabantu specifically, there's an episode of the podcast with Erica Borman and Daniel Schricker. Read Erica's amazing memoir, Mission of Malice, if you want to learn more about that specific group. So growing up in this kind of controlling environment, you later found yourself in a series of abusive relationships. I was wondering what aspects of the dynamics and beliefs in KSB do you think potentially made you susceptible to those types of interpersonal relationships after you had left the cult?
Yeah, so the other part of the teaching that has really had huge ramifications for me was the social structure around interaction between men and women in particular, and we had kind of an arranged marriage paradigm and this sort of extreme, again, I keep using that word, but when we talk about submission in that context, it was really an extreme form of submission, you know, having to ask your husband's permission to read a book or something like that. You know, it was really quite different than just a regular kind of idea of that word. Again, it's really difficult to summarize these things, but it was kind of a system in which women only existed to serve men in every possible way. And as a woman, I was taught that I was also the cause of great evil in the world because women were kind of seen as this walking temptation sent straight from hell to kind of mislead men. And no matter how hard you tried as a woman to keep your eyes lowered, to wear the clothes that didn't show any part of your feminine form or do anything that drew attention to yourself in any way, it was still your fault if men sexually harassed you, assaulted you, or abused you even. And more than that, being a woman meant that when those things did happen to you, or any other kind of degradation or abuse for that matter, actually, you still had to submit to the man and to serve them as a submissive woman. So you weren't allowed any interaction with men before you were married. So no speaking, no texting, no dating. Men kind of sat on the left side of the church, the girls sat on the right, and there was no sex education. So you didn't really know anything about sex or healthy sexual interactions or even normal relational things, I guess, in terms of setting up those life lessons for how to have healthy relationships in general. And when you got to about 16 or 17 as a girl, you would start to be watched by usually much older men who were waiting for you to be old enough to be able to marry. And this process was, I guess, about being assessed as being possible wife material. You had absolutely no power in this process. It was this incredible voyeuristic, misogynistic system in which your whole life's hope could only kind of be that at some point one of these men would pick you and then via the leader offer you a proposal of marriage, apparently by some divine revelation. But it wasn't kind of lost on us as girls that the prettier and more compliant ones always went first.
Always got the divine.
Went first. Yeah, you were not really allowed to speak to anyone about such an offer of marriage, though, once the leader had told you that this person wanted to marry you, for example. Even your own family, you weren't allowed to discuss it with anyone. And so, yeah, you didn't know anything about this man that you'd been asked to marry, but you had to make this huge decision that was going to impact the rest of your life. And my sister, who actually declined such an offer, was threatened by the leadership that she would be cursed with an abusive marriage, as my mother had been, if she refused. So there was a lot of coercion and, yeah, really not a lot of consent and choice that governed any of the interactions sort of interpersonally with people. And then once you were married, you were to obey your husband in all things and were taught that even the right to sexual consent was not really biblical because you were to submit to him at all times, no matter how you felt about it. So I guess when I finally escaped and landed in the outside world, I just felt like I'd been dropped onto another planet. And I very quickly encountered men that realized that I had no concept of consent and could do whatever they wanted to me, really, because I believed that I was never allowed to say no to a man. And I ended up in several really problematic relationships and finally a domestic violence relationship in which I experienced sexual abuse and also ended up in a huge amount of debt.
It's just so heartbreaking to hear. And I always think about the weird dynamic of how these types of fundamentalist religious groups, they teach this concept of, you know, that you are to be submissive, girls and women are basically second-class citizens, lesser than, need to always obey men, and yet are to blame if they are ever assaulted or abused by a man. Like,
absolutely. And that's the, I guess, the thing that I look at back in my life and I go, how did this happen to me? How did I end up in so many relationships, particularly at the start where, you know, these kinds of things happened to me and I was like, why didn't I see it or why didn't I know how to get out of those situations? And then I look back at how I grew up and what I was taught about those kinds of things And I think I didn't have a chance in hell.
Absolutely right. And that whole, you know, not having any sex education, like that becomes a really, really big issue for young people not being able to even have the language to understand what's happening to them if abuse does occur.
Absolutely. And I mean, even the context, and I know that this is something that, as you mentioned, Erica Bornman speaks about, and my brother Daniel has mentioned as well, you know, the other sort of practices around confessing sins and the fact that even children are made to go and confess their sins in private to usually a man, or, you know, sometimes there were women counsellors too. But again, that whole paradigm of a private situation where there was no vetting of these counsellors that were interacting with children. And then you're not giving the children the language to express when bad things are happening to them and they don't understand anything about sexual interaction. You know, you're really setting up a system in which that kind of abuse can just flourish.
And we hear this story, you know, again and again of people coming out of cults and ending up in abusive dynamics because that's a dynamic they've grown up to understand as being acceptable, I suppose, and what they're used to. It's hardly surprising that that often ends up being the case.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think I've heard that saying before, you know, why didn't you see the red flags? And I'm like, if you grew up in red flag country, it doesn't seem strange to you.
That's right. And so following this series of relationships, you then found yourself in a situation that you now understand as sexual exploitation and as a form of modern slavery. Can you tell me a bit about what happened to you next, perhaps starting with what your exploiter recognised almost immediately about your childhood?
Yeah, I guess I'll go back just a little bit to, I guess, the end of that relationship, that last sort of toxic relationship. I had a huge amount of debt from that relationship and I kind of spiraled into this frantic desperation to try and be free of that debt, or actually anything that reminded me of that relationship, to be honest. I had started working as a stripper while I was in that relationship because my partner was unemployed, and then continued even once I left that relationship because of the debt that I'd been left with. And I guess it's interesting because people always ask me, oh, you know, you were raised so conservatively, how would you have possibly contemplated such a step, you know? And I think it's really indicative of the absolute brokenness I was in at that time in that relationship. I remember just collapsing on the ground at one point and just sobbing because I felt like I had no other option to try and get money to help us survive and pay off some of the debts that we'd already accumulated at that point. And when I started, you know, I think I was nauseated for 2 weeks solid. I didn't really eat. And it was a huge stress in the sense of, like, I was, you know, confronting all of this internal moral dilemma that I'd grown up, you know, all of the things that I'd been told about the kind of woman that I would be if I did that kind of thing. You know, it was really intense. But I guess there was also a point at which I just was well past those moralistic kind of sensitivities because I was just completely numb, and I'd experienced so much sexual abuse by that point that I kind of felt like, oh, well, it doesn't really matter what happens to me anymore. And I guess when I was then working as a stripper, there were times where I'd sort of contemplated or been surrounded by sort of environments where people did talk about obviously doing full service or escorting work. And I'd never crossed that line for quite some time when I first started stripping, but eventually it was kind of raised as a thing of, you know, oh, this might be more money and a way to pay off the debt more quickly. And I guess I doubted that anything that I encountered when I was working could even come close to what I'd been living in my real life. And I was like, well, at least this way I'm getting paid for it. And I still stand by that, actually. A lot of the sexual assaults and the abuse that I'd experienced, even to this day, I still feel that that was actually worse than anything I'd experienced in escorting or full service work. And yeah, so I guess eventually I did cross that line, as I said, and started doing some full service work. And at the start, it was kind of a bit of an empowering thing, even because it gave me a way to reclaim sex on my terms. I was doing it for my own benefit in my own way. But there was a kind of bit of a crazy death spiral that was going on for me as well, because I had no idea what I was doing. It was a brand new thing, and I was, you know, taking risks, meeting clients that I didn't know, often without anyone else knowing where I was if something went wrong or anything. So I guess there was that kind of concern for me, like, I'm doing this crazy thing and it's probably not the safest. And it was a friend at the strip club actually that introduced me to a man that she told me he could help me and keep me safer in this work and build me a business that would kind of see me leave poverty behind forever and set me up for life and all of those kinds of things, I guess. And it seemed like such a lifeline. And she assured me that she'd kind of known him for years, and according to her, he was trustworthy and ran this agency in Sydney. And so I agreed to meet him. And originally, we'd planned to go and travel to Sydney together to meet him. She was going to introduce me. And then she strangely pulled out and I decided to go alone. And in hindsight, obviously now, I should have been more concerned by that. But I was also unaware at that point that he actually did pay people to recruit and refer people to him. So yeah, I guess my introduction to the agency and their conditions of work were characterized by deception. This guy promised me that I would be free to work when and how I wanted to in terms of how many bookings I did or what services I offered, and that I was free to leave whenever I wanted. And he kind of did this thing where he started asking me all these questions, which I now realize were really designed to see if I was a kind of suitable target for his manipulation. And he had this uncanny insight and ability to read people in a way that was really intriguing, but kind of equally terrifying as well. So I just have this memory of being like equally kind of entranced by him, but also scared of him. And the first day that I met him, he took me into this kind of side room and was talking about the kind of services I'd be comfortable offering and that kind of thing, and then turned around and said this thing where he went, so, you know, let's talk about your history. You were raised in a cult. And for a moment, I just felt like someone had literally like knocked the breath out of me, because I hadn't actually disclosed my childhood background to many people. I was actually sort of deeply ashamed of it, so didn't really tell a lot of people, and definitely hadn't told this friend who had referred me. So I was like, how could he possibly know? Like, I was like, God, he's so intuitive, you know. He sort of had this ability to kind of see past things that I was able to conceal from other people somehow or something. And he then said something about they'd had another girl that had worked for him that also came from a cult. And he just said, like, she was like you. You'll be perfect as a hooker because you literally have been raised to please men in every possible way. And I just remember that comment really stinging, but just being like, oh, well, at least I'll be okay. It's like, you know, and yeah, I guess even when I had been there for a little while, he used to toy with this part of me that was still so connected to the cult stuff. He would say things like we'd all be sitting around the table and he'd say, you know, Sarah, go and get me a cup of tea. And I would instinctively jump up and do it. And then he'd laugh and everyone would laugh because they're like, oh God, look at Sarah obeying. Like, you know, it was such an ingrained instinctive thing for me to just do what a man told me to do. And yeah, I also had this desperate need for acceptance and a place to belong. After being sort of my world blowing apart, I'd sort of become quite estranged from my family. After getting out of the cult and being excommunicated, you lose your entire social network. So I was kind of desperate for this need to belong somewhere and for people to connect with. And he would say things like, oh, we're your family now. And he made me feel like I was kind of part of a community. And ironically, this is also the kind of process that cults use to recruit people.
Even what you said about the way that he kind of asked questions and could tell things about you, it made me think so much of so many cult leaders too.
I feel like there's like this common thread between perpetrators of both, domestic violence as well, but also, yeah, the connections that I've seen now in my experience of being groomed into a situation of exploitation is so similar to, I mean, I obviously didn't have that experience going into a cult because I was born into a kind of cultic background, but I've now heard from people that say have gotten involved in cults as an adult that have, or, you know, later in life, that have gone through the same process of someone really preying on their need to belong somewhere or to solve problems in their life.
I read about in Jess Hill's book, See What You Made Me Do, she talks about like the spectrum of coercive control and how it's kind of like domestic abuse relationships on one end and kind of totalitarian governments on the other end, and then cults kind of sit somewhere in the middle, and then that pimp relationship that you have with this person as well, just it's within that same spectrum. It's all of these same behaviours.
Yeah, and he actually used to joke about it sometimes that because one of the things that happened then once I was in that space was that I kind of became absorbed in this closed world again, because, you know, he used to tell us like, oh, you know, people won't understand what we do here. He made us keep it very secret. People weren't to know that we were kind of working for him. And there was this kind of, again, it kind of fostered that them and us mentality that the outside world was dangerous and that the only place you were really understood or safe was in this world, this microcosm that he created. And that whole world revolved around him and pleasing him. And I wasn't there alone. He would play the girls off against each other to kind of increase this desperate need to please him. And he sort of started to manipulate people that way. And so there was this initial honeymoon phase, I guess, where I truly believed this man was helping me. I thought he cared about me and that he'd keep me safe in what seemed to be a world that I really couldn't navigate on my own because of how foreign it felt to me. And it wasn't until I was kind of completely immersed in that situation, though, that I sort of started to find out that a lot of the things he'd promised me, including the working conditions, weren't really true. And I guess the thing that always gets me is that he's probably one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. But this compulsion that he had to manipulate and dominate everyone around him soon started to sort of become quite problematic. And like many abusers in cults and domestic violence relationships, he had this way of just disarming people, even when he was engaging in behavior that was entirely unacceptable. Even with that grooming process taking months, actually, and I still sort of had one foot in, one foot out for a little while, but it was then a sort of income-ending ankle injury that then pushed me to make the decision to actually move to Sydney full-time and work for him. So then after that happened, I also found myself to be sort of one of a succession of women that he lured into this kind of pseudo-relationship with him, and he started to exert this increasing amount of control over every aspect of my life and work. And other than what we called it, you know, being at the office to work, I was virtually living at his place, cleaning his house, nursing him back to health after his drug binges, and just satiating his sort of seemingly limitless appetite for attention and sexual gratification. And I think you've probably heard a lot about the kinds of people that manipulate people in cults, and I don't feel like that behavior is all that different. Yeah, and I guess once that abuse then became more problematic, and it's an interesting process because, you know, people always ask me this question, at what point did you think there's a problem here? And I think that point probably came far later for me than it would have for other people. I think that's the first step, realization, is that for me, and I look back now on some of the things where I can see now he was testing the waters to see how hard he could push me. I just blew right past it. But then I also, you know, I was like, okay, I do need to try and find a way to get out of this situation. It's not great. It started to outweigh the benefits. I sort of thought, well, I need to try and leave. But I then realized that his anger and the level of control that he had on my life actually made that almost impossible. And I was also dependent on the income that he was providing to survive. At that point, I had no other form of income. And he took 40% of our money, but it still left me with some money to survive on. And the last kind of straw that kind of broke this camel's back was that, you know, I did eventually ask to leave and was then told that I would have to pay a huge buyout fee to kind of buy my profile out to leave, which I didn't have the money for. So yeah, I found myself forced to continue to do sex work for him, often being pressured to provide services that I didn't want to offer. And I always say that, you know, if you build a prison in someone's mind, you don't have to chain them up, which is, I think, something that people can relate to in lots of different cultic situations and abusive relationships, because it's almost that thing that's kind of in plain sight. And when people talk about modern slavery and trafficking and those sorts of things, people have those images in their mind that someone has to be chained up in a basement for this to happen. But this was much more psychological entrapment, I guess.
I think when I started researching this podcast, I had this concept in my mind of cults as being people are on a compound, they're isolated from everyone else. And now I know, obviously, entirely different. Yes, that is often the case, but also often it's people just in society who they might be your next door neighbor and they could still be entrapped in a cult because that's, as you say, it's a prison of their mind.
Absolutely. And I mean, we see the same in domestic violence relationships. And oftentimes these perpetrators, they spend a lot of time not only isolating people from the kind of influences outside, like in that time that I was at the agency, a lot of people didn't know where I was or what was happening with me. I had some contact with the outside world, but I wasn't telling them what was really going on for me. And he scared us a lot about telling people. He made us believe that we would get in trouble if we reached out. And even within the group of girls that were there, he kind of policed our interaction. He kind of kept us all in our own corner and made sure that he would sort of tell us stuff about each other that made us not trust each other and those kinds of things. And if you said anything to another girl and he heard about it and it was slightly critical of his behavior or whatever, you would be questioned about it and subjected to sort of endless tirades of, you know, your disloyalty. And all of those kind of tactics are also used by cults to kind of keep people trapped. They're afraid to talk about what's really going on, even in the group itself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so you said, you know, you kind of didn't see the red flags until perhaps a lot later than a lot of people would because of the things that you'd come to accept from your background. And so at the time that you were experiencing all of this, you wouldn't have been able to name it as trafficking or modern slavery. So I was wondering if you could explain that term modern slavery to me as you understand it now through your journey.
Yeah, I think that journey of understanding what to name this kind of experience, is really complicated and really personal. I actually think that it's not unique to someone with a cultic background to not necessarily have an understanding of what the terms modern slavery or those kinds of experiences might look like, because I think I certainly had never heard the term modern slavery. I had heard the word trafficking before, but again, like, I think society as a whole has a very stereotyped view of what trafficking or modern slavery might be. Like we said earlier, you know, chains, people being locked up, maybe kidnapped on a street to take them to a place where this happens, or maybe there's only certain groups of people that are at risk, maybe, you know, migrant workers, or you know, we have certain stereotypes in our mind that maybe don't apply. You know, I thought someone like me, it would never happen to me, you know, that kind of mentality. And I hadn't heard the word modern slavery before. It was a lawyer actually that first said to me, this is a trafficking situation and a debt bondage situation. Again, another term that I hadn't really heard or had any understanding of. And one of the other issues that we're up against in trying to identify what this kind of experience is that there are actually many, many definitions. And I certainly became very confused trying to even figure out what it was, because there's legal definitions, there's human rights definitions, there's Australian definitions, and then there's more international definitions. And they're all based on different legislation or different interpretations of that. So one of the ways that someone has explained it to me is that it basically is when somebody else acts like they own you, this idea of modern slavery. And a lot of the human rights definitions and the international definitions also have this lens of if there's force, fraud, or coercion that is exploiting someone for personal or commercial gain, that is kind of the central part of this experience. And I think that the use of the word personal in that definition is really interesting as well, because I think our understanding of how someone can be exploited, again, can be so varied. I'm hearing stories of people that are being forced by their boyfriends to, you know, create OnlyFans content, or maybe it's just some other personal gain that someone is getting. And again, that I think also speaks to some of the misconceptions of who we think the perpetrators of these crimes are, in terms of thinking that it's a stranger that would do this to you. But more often than not, and particularly in cultic groups and those kinds of things, it might be family members, it might be, you know, people that you know and trust that actually subject you to exploitation. And for me, coming to an understanding of these words and what they mean was very important, because the impact of this on my life was something that was catastrophic, and it was very different to some of the other abuse that I'd suffered in my life. But I didn't have a name for it. I didn't have a way to frame that pain. And I think words like modern slavery come with a lot of shame, and it's really difficult to accept that you could possibly have experienced something like that. But we do need those words to have the gravity that they do because of the impact that it has on someone's life.
Mm. I really dislike the idea that it should come with shame, because that's always like placing the blame on the wrong person, you know. It's like this victim blaming mentality, like that shame is coming from a place that it shouldn't. You've been exploited and you've been manipulated and taken advantage of, and I don't think that should come with shame. But I think it's like this self-protective mechanism that people want to think that it wouldn't happen to them, so there's a shame attached to it in that sense.
Absolutely. And for people, when they're exploring that they've had this kind of experience or disclosing it, we don't see, I know in the gender-based violence movement and in the domestic violence space, we've seen survivor advocacy and people actively throwing that shame off by speaking up and by speaking about the experiences, and then other people can see, oh, look, I'm not alone. I'm not the only person that's experienced that. But unfortunately, when it comes to, particularly in Australia, survivor advocacy around issues of exploitation or human trafficking, those conversations have not been had yet. We're not seeing people openly advocating. We're not seeing survivors in numbers that would make other people feel like, oh gosh, look, I'm not alone. So that's why I guess this has been an important journey for me to kind of come to terms with what this is, but then also to start to have those conversations with people that does start to address some of that shame.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that you're able to do that, I think, is just wonderful and fantastic. I was just speaking with a lawyer in the US last week, Carol Murchison. I don't know if you've come across her name before.
I haven't actually, no.
And yeah, she was talking about this whole trafficking side of things as it kind of connects with cults, but also sexual exploitation as well, because she's looking at ways and currently pursuing a couple of ways. Obviously, the laws are different in different countries, but because she saw that, yeah, trafficking was one of the charges against Harvey Weinstein. And she was like, where did trafficking come into this?
Yep.
And it is, as you just said, it's the kind of use of deception and fraud to get people to do things.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, because I think one of the things that's important to understand is that trafficking and exploitation can happen in any industry. It happens, you know, frequently in agriculture, hospitality, a whole range of different industries. But obviously, one of the stereotypes that we have is that it happens in the sex industry. I obviously can attest to that. But I think some of the understanding that people have about like what makes it sex work and what makes it sex trafficking, if you're going to use those words, becomes very complex because of, like you mentioned, there are so many different jurisdictions in which sex work is legalized, not legalized, criminalized. There are different lenses that people look at this through. And I guess in some places where sex work is criminalized, they would almost consider that all forms of sex work are trafficking. In New South Wales, obviously, we are in a decriminalized state that recognizes sex work as legitimate work and it's legal. And I actually personally, even though I've had the experiences that I've had, I don't actually have an issue with sex work, as long as it is safe, autonomous and consensual and somebody is making that choice for themselves and they're not being forced to do it against their will, either by a person or a circumstance even. So that's the lens that I see sex work and sexual exploitation through. It all comes down to that issue of consent.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to make as well, and a good one. So can you just kind of looking at the terms that we're using a little bit more deeply as well, where does modern slavery fit in with terms like servitude, forced labor, and exploitative labor?
I mean, it's really interesting the language around these offences, and I've only just started to wrap my head around them. I guess words like forced labour come under sort of what you would see as more legal terminology. Modern slavery is being used sort of almost like an umbrella term that actually contains sort of a spectrum of offences that falls under what they call modern slavery offences. And things like forced labour are often used in relation to, say, agricultural work, or there are sexual servitude offences where someone's being forced to do sex work against their will. And you can go and look up the legislation. It's mostly federal. We do have modern slavery legislation here in New South Wales, but most of the legislation related to these offences is federal.
I'm wondering, as someone who's had experiences across a multitude of different areas in all aspects of this type of stuff, which, I mean, is just heartbreaking to hear about, I just wondered whether you think that certain cults are operating in ways that mean some of their members are experiencing things that would fit within these definitions.
I think one of the reasons it was so wonderful to have the opportunity to speak to you about this is that I feel really strongly that cults fit very squarely into this issue, in that not only do they employ coercive and deceptive tactics that sort of entrap people, but we see that that extends to people's work conditions too. When people live in cults, you know, and even KSB that I grew up in, many cults have what they would call sort of church businesses that they run commercially. And oftentimes it's the only actual contact with the outside world. But the people that are working within those businesses are cult members that are working usually under conditions that we would call modern slavery. They're working under force. They have no choice about whether they're working in those businesses or not, because there's actually no other option. And, you know, because it's a closed community, they're not presented with many other options. The people that I grew up with had never done a job interview in an outside work business. Like the women, some of the men, I think, worked in outside businesses. But the women, for example, had only ever worked in the business that was run by the church. So wouldn't even have known how to apply for another job elsewhere. And a lot of the other things that happen in businesses that are run by cults is that, you know, you see people doing incredibly long hours. You have sort of wage theft situations where they're not being paid appropriately, or the church or the cult is confiscating some of that money. And there's this kind of working for God principle, this kind of act of service where people are being exploited for labor within a cult context. And we've recently seen the Gloria Vale case recognize that formally, that their members were deemed to have been working in slave-like conditions. Often, you know, this is an issue that we haven't really thought about. How does this intersect with cults? And to me, a lot of the businesses that are run by these cults, we really do need to be having a think about, like, how do these conditions actually exist in those places, and what does that mean for its members?
Yeah, because so many of the things that you've spoken about, they really strike me as showing up in many of the cults that I've looked at, and people are coming out of these organisations having worked for no money for years.
Absolutely.
Yet it's not considered that, you know, any wrongdoing has actually happened.
Has happened. Yeah, and I think this is where knowledge is power, because understanding, like, I didn't have the language or the knowledge of what these things were. And like you said, a lot of people in cults wouldn't even think that what they experienced, basically enforced labour conditions in those businesses, actually qualifies as something that they could get help with.
Yeah. And so in terms of avenues that people who might be listening to this and thinking, well, that actually was my experience, avenues that they can take, you have set up a resource for people who've experienced exploitative situations. And so can you please tell me about Survivor Connections?
Yes. So when I first got out of what I'm going to call the trafficking situation, I couldn't make sense of what had happened to me, but I also couldn't find a lot of information or help out there. I sort of spent hours and hours like trying to figure out what this even was. And a lot of survivors have said this to me, like they're trying to figure out, do I even qualify as having had this kind of experience? Couldn't find any other survivors to connect with, to talk to about this stuff. So Survivor Connections is the first Australian survivor-led support group for people that have experienced human trafficking, modern slavery, or other exploitation. And what we've done first is to kind of create a resource website containing all of the information that I wish I would have known before, during, and after. And it was put together with a group of survivors that all had input into the various things that they wished they'd known as well. So we hope that people being able to access a resource that kind of puts some of that information all in one place. It's everything from, you know, what are the definitions to what is the legislation? Like, how do I report this if I want to report it? Who do I go to for help? If there's any organizations that, you know, do help, the ones that we list on the website are ones that survivors have actually received help from, so we know that they can go there and get some help. Yeah, but then it's also a support group. We run a weekly support group online that people join from actually around Australia now. And it's really interesting because I think it's the first time that people have found other people to talk to where we can kind of explore our healing journeys from this. So yeah, it's been really meaningful for me to create this thing that I wished I'd had when I got out.
I mean, that just sounds so wonderful and so great that you're doing that. Where do people go to find Survivor Connections?
They can go to survivorconnections.org. That is our website. And there's an Instagram page at Survivor Connections. We are expanding some of our social media presence as we speak. And yeah, this was created entirely unfunded, just with a small group of survivor or survivor adjacent communities, people that have experienced other forms of abuse, you know, brilliant people that can code and build a website from scratch that I'm just so incredibly proud of the people that have come together in spite of really struggling with still some pretty difficult circumstances around homelessness and health, you know, issues from what happened to us, and that we've still being able to come together as a group of survivors and create this thing that we hope is going to help other people.
So you're really wonderful. And all of those links will be in the show notes. And so if someone has had an experience, whether within a cult or not, that they think would fit the definition of exploitative labour, what are the steps that they could take in Australia if they would like to see whether any action can be taken?
I think the first thing that I would tell people to do is do some research. And I know that that sounds like it puts the onus again on the person, but it honestly, it is such a complex issue. And I think until you have the right language to ask for help from, say, certain organizations or certain places, it's very difficult to get the right help if you don't know the right words to use. So do some learning. Like I said, if you want to go to something like Survivor Connections that has a whole list of definitions, we have listed on the website the particular legislation, both state and federal. Have a look at what the legislation says. And then based on that, there are a few different options. The people to go to first, if you fit the criteria from a legal perspective, is the federal police, the AFP. I can provide you with the links. Actually, there's a specific part of the AFP website where you can report online, or you can also ring the number. There are also some other services that you can get advice from. There's free legal services from Inner City Legal or Redfern Legal Centres, for example, that have done quite a lot of work with people that have had these kinds of experiences. So even if it's just a matter of reaching out and saying, you know, hey, you know, this is my experience, what is the legislation, stuff like that. And I guess even if it's just wanting to talk to another survivor, reach out to Survivor Connections. We've got our email address listed on the website or on Instagram. Sometimes just talking to someone who's had a similar experience can be really clarifying and help to kind of direct you, even if you're like, well, who do I talk to? Chances are we may have figured that part out and might be able to send people in the right direction. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. And what I'm hearing is that there's always an evolving understanding of these laws and how people are exploited. So over time, I guess I'm really hopeful that we might see some more positive movement in this area. And it's great to see that there's movement happening now and with the work that you're doing as well.
Absolutely. And I think the most important part of that happening is by getting survivors together to start to speak about these things, because the more visible we become, the more we speak about these issues, the more services and governments can respond. There's this huge misconception, or this huge struggle that people have, I guess, to quantify how many people have been exploited or might be in these kinds of situations. And there's a few different ways that people have tried to estimate these numbers. Currently, the most recent number was said to be 41,000 people in Australia, 16,000 of them being in New South Wales. But one of the things that we know is that a lot of times, you know, this is also seen through the lens of how many people are reporting these crimes. And just from my own experience, but also knowing how little people know about this issue, I feel like that number is a gross underrepresentation, because even if you just look at our situation in the, you know, there were about 21 of us that I know of in the time that I was sort of working in that place, only two of us have been able to report to federal police. So if they're basing numbers on, say, how many people report to police, that's very unlikely to be accurate. And particularly in places that make reporting difficult, obviously someone like myself had numerous really bad experiences with police, and a lot of sex workers are afraid of police, haven't had good experiences, so are unlikely to go to report. But you've also got situations, for example, migrant workers who are on conditional visas that mean that if they're being forced into exploitative situations and potentially are in breach of visa conditions, there's always that threat of retribution that means that they're too afraid to report because they know that it might mean that they're actually harmed. And so I think that's something that we really need to address with survivor advocacy, is like, how do we make it safer for people to actually reach out for help? And then we can talk about maybe where to go for help, because we've got to address that issue first.
Yeah, absolutely right. 100% agree with you. Well, that's come to the end of the questions that I had for you, but is there anything else that you would like listeners to know before we finish up?
I guess my heart is really with cult survivors and, yeah, the people that may have experienced this in cults, but also on reflecting on my own experiences, knowing how much of what happened to me in that place then influenced, you know, further situations of abuse, including this experience of trafficking and modern slavery. Yeah, I guess my heart just goes out to anyone that has been in that situation, and I just want them to know that they're not alone and that this is something that, you know, they don't have to face alone.
Thank you so much for sharing your experiences. I think you're amazing for doing it, and just really appreciate your time today, Sarah.
Well, thank you for everything you do as well. And I know how important getting messages out is, and the podcast that you do, particularly to the cult and post-cult kind of communities, is so, so very important. So thank you for everything you do also.
Thanks so much for listening, and you can find links to Survivor Connections and the other resources we mentioned in the show notes. You can access early and ad-free episodes and support the production of this independent podcast via Patreon, patreon.com/LTASpod, or with a one-off donation or merch purchase. You can also grab a copy of my book, Do As I Say. That link's in the show notes too. If you've been personally affected by involvement in a cult or would like to support those who have been, you can find support with or donate to Cult Information and Family Support if you're in Australia, and you can find resources outside of Australia with the International Cultic Studies Association. Let's Talk About Sects is produced and presented by me, Sarah Steele. Editing and mixing by Matt Brazel, and with music by Joe Gould, whose wonderful soundtrack album, Nobody Joins a Cult, is out now. Thanks again to Sarah for being so incredibly open with her story for today's episode.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Kia ora world, I'm Kaz.
I'm Liz.
And I'm Lindy.
And together we are Cult Chat. We're coming to you over the airwaves from little old Aotearoa, New Zealand, land of flightless birds, hobbits, marmite, and also some really wacky groups. And that's why we're here.
On Cult Chat, we ask whether Kiwis know how to recognise a culty group and give tips on how to sniff out the telltale signs that a group is harmful.
Join us as we unpack the cult playbook, talk to survivors of New Zealand cults, and interview experts in the field. Journey with us as we traverse the cultiverse.
Cult Chat is available on various streaming platforms and social media.